Good afternoon. You're listening to KTOO. I'm Yvonne Krumrey. Thank you for tuning in. Ketchikan's city manager is resigning. Delilah Walsh sent her resignation letter to the city council Tuesday, announcing that she'll be stepping down in late February. Walsh has been the city's chief administrator since 2022, after a career as a county manager in her home state of New Mexico. Walsh is returning to New Mexico to accept a job offer at her alma mater, New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology.
That's all official now. So I accepted a vice president of administration position with the university at New Mexico Tech.
Walsh says she's sad to be leaving Ketchikan, though, and that the decision was not made lightly. In an email to city staff, Walsh said, quote, "Serving this community has been one of the most fulfilling and rewarding experiences of my career," unquote. She added that she was proud of what city staff had achieved together in her roughly 2 years in the position. Walsh worked for nearly all of her time in Ketchikan under former Mayor Dave Kiffner. Kiffner says Walsh was a steady influence in council chambers.
And the big thing that she did was to get the council to sit down and say, hey, you know, these are our four or five or six priorities. These are the things that we want to do going forward.
Kiffer says the city council will likely appoint an interim manager when Walsh departs in February. But Kiffer says Walsh will not be easy to replace, especially since hiring from outside Alaska can be difficult. The cost of living is high, and salaries often struggle to be competitive.
It is a challenge to find just the right person who can deal with the challenges of being the city manager in Ketchikan, which is not just managing the city, but it's also managing the utility.
The Ketchikan city manager also oversees the city-owned power, water, and telecommunications utilities. The city said they plan to post a job opening for a new city manager soon. The bipartisan caucuses who will control the Alaska House and Senate have announced their committee chairs. The biggest changes will come in the House, as it flips from a Republican-led coalition to one predominantly made up of Democrats and independents. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone has a look at what's in store.
In its announcement, the multi-party House coalition made up of two Republicans, five independents, and 14 Democrats spotlights a few committees especially critical to its agenda. The House Education Committee will be co-chaired by two Southeast Alaskans with a background in the field, including Sitka independent and retired teacher Rebecca Himshute.
Well, the caucus priority is also our priority in terms of getting more of a stabilized funding stream to our schools, and the sooner we can do that, the better.
Himshute says passing a long-term education funding boost early in the session would allow school districts to avoid last-minute budget maneuvering, the kind that often requires school districts to temporarily lay off teachers and staff. That was the idea last session, too. The House and Senate passed a bill with a nearly $700 boost to per-student funding early on, but Governor Mike Dunleavy refused to sign it, and lawmakers fell one vote short of overriding his veto. Lawmakers eventually settled for an equivalent one-year boost in the state operating budget, but it wasn't approved until the last day of the session in May. Lawmakers would have to raise the so-called base student allocation by at least $680 to match the current funding level, but Himshute says it's not yet clear what figure they'll be aiming for.
We also have to be aware that the price of oil is not helpful right now, so it's going to be a lot of negotiation to arrive at a number, but I think that there's a lot of focus on getting to that number quickly.
Himshute says another focus for helping the state's struggling schools is improving the retirement system for public employees. Many members of the majority campaigned on returning to a pension system from the current defined contribution system that's akin to a 401k account. Leaders say the majority is also focused on cutting energy costs. Key to that effort will be the co-chairs of the House Resources Committee, which for the first time in at least 30 years and maybe ever will be two Alaska Native women, including Robin Nyack-Burke, a Democrat from Ukiagvik.
Well, I anticipate that oil and gas and Coquimbo, it's still going to be a huge topic moving forward into this next session. I think that it's not typical, you know, for Democrats to be pro-resource development, but I think you can't be a Democrat on the North Slope without being pro-resource development.
Burke says concerns with the Biden administration's restrictions on oil and gas drilling on federal land were a big part of why villages in the region shifted markedly towards Trump. Burke says she's opposed to importing liquefied natural gas to supplement the dwindling supplies in Cook Inlet. She says she'd rather see lawmakers look closely at what they can do to support the construction of a long-dreamed natural gas pipeline from the North Slope. And she says she'll prioritize consultation with tribal leaders on resource projects. Burke will share the resources chair with a fellow pro-development Democrat, Maxine Dybert of Fairbanks.
We are a resource state, and Alaskans own these resources. That's what I hear a lot, too. They want them developed, albeit responsibly.
The House majority, according to the press release announcing the committee chairs, stands at a fragile 21. That's exactly as many as they need for control of the 40-member chamber. Leaders say they'd like to attract some more support from across the aisle, and the failure of the ranked choice and open primary repeal does blunt the threat of crossover Republicans being primaried from the right. But so far, that hasn't happened. In the Senate, where the current bipartisan majority will maintain control, leaders say many committee chairs will remain unchanged. But the majority may be a bit smaller this time around. The Senate's announcement lists 14 members, notably not including Anchorage Republican Senator James Kaufman, a prior member of the coalition. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
And Alaska's commercial salmon harvest plummeted this year, according to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The department's annual report shows that the statewide harvest of over just 100 million fish was the third lowest on record, and the pounds harvested were the lowest on record. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, the numbers came with a decline in the fishery's overall value, too.
The poor harvest results were driven mostly by weak pink salmon returns statewide. Bristol Bay's annual sockeye run, the most valuable salmon fishery in the state, saw another good year. The southeast region saw lower runs across the board, except for chums. But pink salmon, which are harvested in the millions across the state, drove the overall harvest numbers way down. Pinks run on a two-year cycle, and even years are always lower than odd years. But 2024 saw a dramatic swing. The overall harvest was 42% below projections.
So that was a bit unexpected.
Forrest Bowers is the state's deputy director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries.
Even with that awareness of the distinct even odd year cycle of pink salmon, returns for pink salmon were poor in 2024, even for an even year.
The weak returns dragged down the fishery's overall value, too. This year's statewide salmon harvest across all species was worth $94 million less than last year, according to Fish and Game's report. Bauer says the pink salmon harvest gaps between even and odd years have become more pronounced over the past decade. And biologists don't know why. They have lots of data from managing salmon in freshwater rivers and lakes.
Knowing that our freshwater habitat in Alaska is largely intact and is very productive, then you're sort of left with the question of what happens to those fish when they're in the ocean. And we believe that those ocean conditions and survival of salmon in the ocean is largely what drives the strength of these returns.
And that's the million-dollar question, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on in the ocean?
Right. When these fish leave freshwater as juveniles and enter the marine environment, if the food that they need at that point in their life history isn't there where they need it to be, that can certainly contribute to mortality.
Southeast Alaska is the state's second most valuable salmon region after Bristol Bay's sockeye run. The region commercially harvests all five salmon species through seining, gill netting, and trolling. Southeast's harvests for Chinook, sockeye, and coho were below average this year. Chum salmon, which are supplemented with several hatcheries, were abundant. The region's pink harvests actually bucked the statewide trend and came in above predictions by 2 million fish. Bauer says another trend this year was smaller-sized fish, which affects overall pounds being sold. He says they've noticed smaller fish in many salmon stocks statewide, especially kings and sockeye.
We're seeing fish not only return at younger ages, which would generally lead us to see smaller fish, but also fish that are smaller for a given age.
But Bauer says people should keep this year's commercial harvests in perspective. Yes, 2024 was a small harvest compared to recent years. But he says overall, the state is in a period of relatively high abundance. For instance, there's been just 10 seasons that Alaska's salmon harvests have exceeded 200 million fish, going all the way back to the mid-70s. And six of those years have been in the last decade.
You know, 2024 isn't that much different than harvests that we saw in 2016, 2018, and 2020. Between those poor even-year harvests, we had some of the largest harvests on record in those odd-numbered years.
A statewide Alaska Salmon Research Task Force worked for a year to come up with recommendations for managing the state's salmon stocks, particularly declining runs in western Alaska. In its final report released this summer, the task force found that more scientific research is needed on several factors impacting salmon, from climate change to harvesting to predators and habitat. Another task force focusing on the state's seafood industry is working on recommendations for next year's legislative session. Reporting for Coast Alaska, in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And people can now view a live stream feed of Cook Inlet beluga whales swimming in the Kenai River. The Alaska Wildlife Alliance and the city of Kenai launched two beluga monitoring webcams that went live last week. Teresa Becker is the Kenai coordinator for the Alaska Beluga Monitoring Program, which partners with the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. She says the cameras are pointed at the mouth of the Kenai River and just past the Kenai City Dock.
So we placed the two cameras in areas where we think the belugas are likely to be seen as they swim by certain areas.
The stream provides an aerial view of the two popular beluga monitoring sites. The cameras were installed this summer next to the city's existing dipnet camera infrastructure. They were paid for by the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. Dan Castamore, IT manager for the city of Kenai, says the install was simple.
It's good for the city because we're always trying to increase our coverage for dipnet fishery. And so that was one of the reasons this was a great opportunity. So it allowed us to add additional cameras at no cost to the city.
While the live stream cameras provide a chance to view beluga whales remotely, Becker says they also allow for research opportunities for students of Kenai Peninsula College. If the live stream is successful, the Alaska Wildlife Alliance hopes to add more beluga monitoring cameras to its fleet. The Kenai River's beluga monitoring season ends this month, but will start back up in March. You can view a live stream from the beluga monitoring cameras by visiting the Alaska Wildlife Alliance's YouTube channel. This is KTOO.